Let's just kick off immediately with Christine, who was on this show many times in the past, but now you've now become a Green councillor. How did that happen?
Well, I've stood a few times as an independent, namely in 2016 for the mayor, because of my educational expertise. And this time around, I was going to stand again, and then I was approached by Tony Dyer, who I've known for a number of years, and he said, look, you know, there's a seat going on in Southfield, how do you fancy it? So, and I thought, well, where am I going to get most traction here? Is it a stand-in for as an independent mayor again, or is it actually having a chance of being elected and therefore being a councillor? So that was how I made that decision.
Well, it's interesting because the Greens are very much up and coming here because of the slow falling in popularity of the Labour Party generally. I'm quite fascinated by the fact that the Greens probably stand the best next chance of grabbing the whole mayor thing, and yet the Greens voted against or for having a referendum for the mayor. So I mean, this is, to me, says there's something a little bit different about the Green Party in the city, in that, although you may have been able to, by stopping the referendum, to have a mayor, because we're now going back to decide whether we wanted, whether having a mayor has been a good idea or not. If the Greens had voted to actually against that referendum, you, as a party, though, might have stood more chance of getting power across the whole city.
That what you've said is absolutely correct, because with the number of councillors we now got, we could have, if we voted against that motion, then it wouldn't have gone through. We wouldn't be having a referendum. But the Green Party is about bringing democracy as down to through the system as far as possible to the people. And what the mayoral system does is concentrate that political power in the hands of one elected person. So it fundamentally goes against sort of Green Party ideology and Green Party policy. So it would be highly hypocritical just because we think we might be with a chance of winning it to vote against that motion.
Well, that sounds like a bit of a breath of fresh air actually through the city, because that's what we really need. The two main parties' politics over the years has become rather stultified. But look, the main reason we want to talk to you today is about the acquittal of these four people who committed criminal damage. Can you just take us through the story of how the statue got toppled in the first place? Because I know you've been campaigning, you know, through different routes, through approaching the council, through asking people to get the statue removed for years.
Absolutely. This is a story that goes back to the 1920s. There's each generation brings protest and kind of, you know, emotions and pleas to the powers that be and those with the decision making powers to do something about that statue.
So I'm guessing the statue went up in the 1800s, did it?
Yeah, 1895. Yeah. It
right,
was put
okay.
up.
106. So it didn't take long for there to be protests.
No, absolutely. Well, it was 174 years after the man died that the Victorian merchants thought, they want to have a statue of the man put up. And that's when the myths around Colston kind of started to get created and propagated. And people started to speak out against it in the 1920s. But it really started to kick off in the 1970s. So countering Colston, which has been around for, you know, campaigning 7 or 8 years now, we're just one of a line of many, many different groups of Bristolians that have been trying to raise awareness about basically the myths and the lies about how Bristolians understand Colston.
Well, yeah, but, you know, there's people all around the world looking at what's going on in Bristol here and saying, hang on, you're trying to erase history.
Well,
you're trying to knock this guy down and get rid of him, throw him away like he never existed.
And yet, all those people around the world that are now saying that never knew what Colston was before it went in the drink would be my response to that. So, I mean, you know, you don't learn history from statues. It's as simple as that. History is in the archives. It's in historical books and it's in museums. Yeah. The purpose of statues is to venerate people and to kind of say, this is these people are good and we should try and emulate them. And he was a mass murderer. That's what he was about. He was the architect of, the transatlantic slave trade, and our young people in our city just said, we don't want this person there anymore, get rid of it.
Yeah, Martin, it's almost like the city is starting to face up to this rather nasty past, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and it only went up in the 1890s, and previously, of course, there was quite a strong anti-slavery movement in Bristol. The other statue down in the centre is of Edmund Burke, who was elected as an MP for Bristol in the 1790s, And he turned out to be against the slave trade, which, of course, the people who'd elected him, a very small minority of the population, were furious because that's how they'd made their money. And then he made his famous defence of representative democracy, saying, you voted for me as a jolly good fellow and for my judgment. And what you want isn't what matters. My judgment as the MP is that slavery is wrong. And then, of course, he was not re-elected.
Oh, he also said, I mean, I don't think it's on the actual statue, but Burke has famously said, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing.
And that's that's his most famous
quote.
That
message is probably very important today in Bristol. There's quite a lot of people sort of twiddling their thumbs thinking, for the last 20, 30 years, as you've been saying, right back to the 1920s, saying, oh, this, we don't really want to upset the merchant venturers and the powerful in the city by taking this statue down.
I agree with you. I think that those in political positions have been and continue to be so influenced by the Society of Merchant Venturers that it became in their interest to kind of to brush under the carpet and not really respond to the representations that were coming forward from the people.
Well, I mean, you flattered me when you just before we came on air by saying that I started this. Well, no, I don't think I did, but certainly we played a part. It was a musician called Tim and I that went in there, I think it would be about 2014, into the cathedral on the Charter Day service, which is where the Bishop of Bristol, at the time it was Bishop Mike, gives a sermon to all the collected school children from the... there's a particular academy, I'm sure you'll tell me
Venturers
what it is.
Venturers Trust.
Okay, the Venturers Trust, the merchants. This is the Merchant Venturers schools that they control here in Bristol and run these privatised academies schools. The bishop, we were just about, let me tell you the story about what happened, because Tim and I cheekily walked in, as everyone else walked in. We sat down in a place hoping not to be noticed, and I had my phone with me ready to record what was going on, if necessary. And so somebody came up to us and said, well, where are your tickets? And I wasn't expecting that at all. But anyway, eventually we agreed, oh, okay, we'll leave, because they were actually holding the service up because of us, because we wouldn't leave. Anyway, so we started to leave, and it was a lovely, we were just going towards the main exit of the cathedral, and some lovely verger or minor vicar of some sort came up to us and said, okay, you can sit down just over there, it'll be fine. You know, and so we sat down behind a couple of pillars at the back of the cathedral, at which point there was a bit of a service and some hymns, and the bishop started to give a sermon. I thought, well, I better record this in case he says anything interesting. And then actually what he did say was pretty devastating, which was that he was talking about Edward Colston to these school children and suggesting to them that his involvement in the slave trade was just speculation. Now, this is a pretty devastating thing to say, but I was very glad to see that the phone had you could only just about hear it, but managed to record what he said. So what this tells me is that we've got an establishment in this city that is abusing its rights over these children in these schools to brainwash them effectively and to try to erase history. And that's where the erasure of history is taking place, is that there are powerful people in the city who are still trying to work for their own benefits. I just wonder if you agree with that.
Yes. I mean, I completely agree with it. And as a teacher, I mean, you know, I've been teaching in my own city for decades. I saw that, and because they're running state schools, there were hundreds of our city's children in that cathedral, and I could not let that lie. And I then put a formal complaint in about the words of that bishop. And at the time, I didn't realise that if you complain about a bishop, it goes to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And it also didn't occur to me that actually that man also sat in the House of Lords, that, you know, because they have lots of seats in the House of Lords, don't they, bishops? And it was kind of like, this is the top of the hierarchy within British establishment lying or to children, to state educated children in my city. Mm-hmm. And that is where kind of, you know, my activism around Colston started. And that's where I realised the influence of this Society of Merchant Venturers, because the cathedral chapter have lay members from the Society of Merchant Venturers sitting on their control board, their governing body, and they still sit there. So the church, the Bristol Council and the Society of Merchant Venturers, they're like a triumvirate within Bristol. And Colston was the one, the thing that enabled splinters between those three institutions to start to appear.
Well, good. Well done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so that lunchtime, as we came out of the cathedral, Tim and I were sort of quite shocked and amazed. And I replayed my phone. Gosh, yes, there he is, saying it's speculation. So I picked up the phone to a chap called Tim Pemberton, who used to be the managing editor of Radio Bristol. I said, hey, Tim, just come out of the cathedral and got something quite interesting here. It's the bishop talking about Colston's role in the slave trade being speculation. And his first words were, did you record it? And I said, yes, I did. So that file found its way up to the BBC quite quickly, and the rest is history, because there was, there were some pretty shocked people around the city. I think it's rather sinister, actually, the idea that you're telling all these school children to come into a cathedral just to lie to them about the city's past. It's something quite spooky about that, actually.
I completely agree. And at the end of these rituals and these ceremonies, which the society and, you know, religious institutions largely, they kind of like that, don't they? They gave the children, you know, the Colston bun, in order. Now, children might not listen to the words of old white men in, you know, cathedrals or other religious buildings, but they remember that they get a cake at the end of it. And what you're doing with young children is you are forming what it is, part of their identity. So it's about, you know, you're part of this group. Colston's a great man. He's a philanthropist. Don't listen to those that would put Colston down. And that's what was described in the 1920s as the cult of Colston. By the Reverend H.J. Wilkins, which was something that countering Colston, the historians that worked with us, we discovered that this cult of Colston was, had been used in the 20s, and we started to reuse those words and to reuse that as a description.
Well, I mean, it might be overused, the word cult, but it is a bit like that. When you start actually looking at the merchants, they are incredibly secretive, very secretive. For a long time, they were secretive about who their members were. So you can now find out who the members are, but find out absolutely nothing about their financial affairs, which, of course, are the main issue here. One of the things I've done over the years is, you know, try to figure out where is their power and influence, because obviously they're very wealthy. Where are their shares? Which businesses have they got shares in? And you can, just by kind of a form of reverse logic, find out, because if you find a merchant venturer on the board of a business, then you can guarantee that they've got enough shares in that company in order to nominate directors. So you can just do it by reverse, but you can't find out from the company's house, because this is a royal charter. It's only Jacob Rees-Mogg and his Privy Council that can actually open the books of the merchant venturers to start to have a look. Where is this money? And is it actually going to the philanthropic purposes that they say it is?
My understanding is that the leader of the opposition also sits on this Privy Council that can therefore see these books. So Keir Starmer,
you'd have to lobby the Privy Council. The Privy Council would, I think, as well, I understand it, the Privy Council would have to agree to open the books. You know, if you're just one person on there, I don't doubt if you can manage it. I'm not sure if you think Keir Starmer is going to do that.
My understanding is that the leader of the opposition sits on this Privy Council, which is where these the books and the finances can be seen. We've got a Labour city, apparently. We've got a Labour mayor. We've got four Labour MPs. They can have a word with their leader, can't they? About let's open this up. But surely the society, if they got to that point, could open up their own books, or they just say, we don't want the Royal Charter anymore.
Can you just give us an idea of the extent of the Merchants Academy network in the city? How many school children are they, you know, in charge of educating? What ages?
Yeah, at the moment, they run 8 state-funded academies, one of which is an autism special needs school. So they educate, so 4 of them are secondary age children, and 4 of them are primary age children. So we're talking probably around, about 10,000 children, something like that. What was Colston Girls, now Montpellier High School, since the statue went in the drink, was a private school, because up until the academy system, the only schools that this institution ran were the private schools. So when you're educating your children at private schools, we know where those children end up in terms of the pyramids of power. So these are people that come out of their schools and go into the judiciary and the legal system and the political system, and their minds are fixed about who Colston was, and that explains why it is that there was so much pushback when we were kind of going, what are you doing? Why, you know, why is it that you're saying that Colston was this great philanthropist and you're not giving the historic reality of the man's life in the round?
I mean, this is a privileged elite protecting its power, Martin, in modern Britain. I mean, working in schools as well. What is going on?
I've actually worked in several schools which are run by the merchants in primary schools.
Yeah, so am I. I worked in their first academy.
But of course, they never used to run any state schools before the academy system came in. And of course, Colston Girls' Schools become part of the state system now. But Colston Boys' School remains a private school.
Yes.
But I understand that they are going to change their name from Colston as well. And of course, a direct result of what happened is that lots of institutions in the city, including the cathedral, to be fair, they immediately covered up their stained glass window of Colston, and it's probably going to be removed. And the Colston Hall is no longer going to be called the Colston Hall. It's going to be called something else. So in other words, this was like lancing a boil, really, in terms of the long-term campaign against the statue and what it represented. And I think that's what the defence made this case very strongly in the court, and I know you were at the court, was that this is a specific case about a specific statue. And that doesn't mean there's a precedent for anybody to go around trashing statues. Although, incidentally, we're going to come and talk about Kazakhstan later, a statue of Nazarbayev, who is the former president, was pulled down. Should those people get 10 years in prison?
Was he a slave trader? Anyway, let's not go there. We can talk about that in a minute. But anyway, look, it's being in the court case. Can you just take us through some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, so it was an 8-day trial, so I wasn't down there the whole time. But the historian and TV presenter David Olusoga gave a full day of evidence in defence of for one of the accused. So the jury got a really good history lesson, not only about Colston but also about the transatlantic slave trade and the true horrors and the realities of the inhumanity with which enslaved Africans were treated. You know, as they were sort of captured, and then the Middle Passage as they went over to the Caribbean, and how they were then treated on the plantations. But so that was a highlight, I think, and that would have had a massive impact. But there were also a couple of statements and evidence given by people of Afro-Caribbean descent, local Bristolians, explaining their own experiences of that legacy of racism, because it was necessary for those with dark coloured skin to be dehumanised in order for sort of those that were on the plantations to kind of live with themselves, I suppose, in knowing how people were being treated, and that legacy of racism, and the impact that it still has as it kind of comes down the centuries to today. So that was also very interesting. The prosecution witness was an officer from Bristol City Council. I mean, you know, come on. It was Bristol City Council that failed to act, and then they're speaking for the prosecution.
Yeah, well, it's their property, I suppose. They've got to put somebody up, and they might not have particularly enjoyed having to do the job. anyway, I mean, this does say something, doesn't it, about if we go back to the slave trade itself, about the way that things are done far away from the city, but the city itself is profiting. And I think that's probably true today of so much that goes on in this world, is that, so for example, things going on in Kazakhstan today, it's the way that it's reported or not reported that really counts. And so the idea really is to get on with stuff, and so long as you can do it on the quiet, you can get away with it.
I would completely agree, yes. I mean, this was a big thing that was always thrown at countering Colston was, why are you talking about historic atrocities? Why don't you focus on modern day slavery? Certainly the Society of Merchant Venturers and the Cathedral wanted us to focus on that. And it was kind of, well, you know, firstly, you could do both. You know, they're not mutually exclusive, would be the first thing. But it's kind of, as long as it's out of sight, it's out of mind. It's that kind of old saying, really, isn't it? And if it's in front of you, then you feel you need to kind of do something about that. And I think that plays into global warming and climate change as well. It's like, until it's on your doorstep, and the weather is changing year on year, which is what we're currently seeing, and certainly in the States they're seeing it.
Well, I just want to chip in. you know, not that I'm a great fan of Prince Charles and Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates at their talks at the COP26, but we've had a remarkably mild holiday, particularly over Christmas, very mild. But so the point here really is about, whether we are actually dealing with these issues. And what about slavery today? A lot of people feel, I mean, we're going to be hearing some clips in a little while from Prime Minister's questions about energy prices. But people are afraid to open their energy bills because they feel they're working all the hours God sends and they can't afford to pay the rent, they can't afford to pay the bills. This in itself is a form of slavery, surely. I mean, you know, obviously it's nowhere near as bad as being, you know, chained up and thrown overboard dead on the way across the Atlantic, but it still is, you know, this is not freedom.
I mean, people having being able to afford to live and have a decent standard of living is a fundamental human right, isn't it? And we have a long way to go on that, and progress is not linear, is it? I mean, you know, it is a continual struggle to bring people up to standards that that would be acceptable for human beings to live in.
Well, and to hold the rich and powerful to account, the people who are supposed to be, you know, running things. Martin, what do you make of this? Am I exaggerating to talk about modern day slavery?
Well, you've got to. Slavery is a specific historical thing. So we, you know, there is plenty of people in this on this planet who are living in conditions which were comparable to slavery, whether you call it chattel slavery or not, and that is certainly the case.
Well, I mean, wage slavery, you might call it.
Wage slavery, yeah, but some people are living in conditions which are not dissimilar to that. That's definitely true. You know, in the United States, the Confederate statues, which have been cause of such contention over there, they went up at about the same time as the Colston statue. They weren't put up in the aftermath of the Civil War, because in actual fact the slavers had lost the Civil War. Hundreds of thousands of people had died. The place was under martial law from the north, and they were not allowed to put up statues to Robert E. Lee. They wouldn't have been allowed to do it. The same would have been true in Bristol, because of the anti-slavery campaigns of the nonconformists and the Methodists and so on in Bristol. It would have been unthinkable to put up a statue. But in the 1890s, it suddenly became more.
It was a bit of a window of opportunity.
Yes, yeah. Because what happened is British imperialism was going into another super overdrive, you know, in the run-up to the Boer War. This was when Britain was suddenly becoming a massive. So the early teething troubles of British imperialism were suddenly going to be renuanced. Yeah, so that was what was going on there. And in the southern United States, the white majority, as it was, were now getting back into the saddle, having been, you know, basically dethroned during the Civil War, and that's when they started putting up Confederate statues. Because of course, lots of black people did have a vote at the end of the Civil War, but gradually it was all taken away from them, which is why you had the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s and so on. So when these people say that these statues are historical, they're not actually being honest about what the history actually is and when they went up and why they went up. It's not a statue of Colston that was put there at the time. Mm. It wouldn't have been acceptable at the time.
174 years after the man died. Right. So, I mean, you know, that's right.
So in other words, this modern cult of Colston is more recent.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And the same is true of the Confederate statues in the US. They didn't go up in the 1860s because they'd just lost the war. And that would have been totally unacceptable to the families of the Union soldiers that had fought to end slavery, for them to put up statues to the people who've been fighting against.
It's almost as if some of these statues went up after a sense of guilt, you know, the idea that, oh crikey, you know, this is somebody that may be dangerous to our reputation, so let's turn them into a hero figure quick before anyone gets the chance to do that. But what about people like Roger as well, Christine, who have been campaigning along these lines? I remember when we were on FM, he came into the studio and talked about something about like bit relics of Colston himself, like, was it bits of his fingernails or bits of his hair or something that they had up at Merchant's Hall? Now this is starting to get a little bit creepy, actually.
Well, yes. At one point Colston was buried in All Saints Church, In the centre of the city. And at some point, the Victorians reopened that coffin and they moved his body up to somewhere in Kent, which is where his family are kind of, where his family were from. And the myth goes that it was kind of, the body was in a was in this kind of almost saint-like, you know, been preserved or something. And so they picked...
He was still smiling.
And they picked off some nails and some hair. Now... It was thought to be a myth, okay? It was thought to be a myth. And whilst, you know, when we were kind of doing Countering Colston, what I did was look at some of the newsletters for Colston Girls School. And I found an old newsletter before they updated all their websites and stuff and downloaded it. And it was written by a child in year seven. And it was entitled Heritage Day. And these were the new children into the school and they'd gone out on this day trip. And she went and she spoke about how they were taken to Merchants Hall, their mansion up in Clifton, and they were shown the nails and hair of Edward Colston. Now, whether it's actually the nails and hair of Edward Colston is kind of irrelevant, because the idea is that, you know, she wrote about it. That was in 2011. So it's kind of irrelevant whether they are or whether they aren't. The fact is that these are people in this organisation that are perpetuating the idea that Colston was this fabulous person. And look, you know, have a look at these kind of, well, Catholic relics, really. It's medieval, isn't it?
Yes, I remember when I was in the cathedral with the merchants. Everyone else was filed out. I think they were the first to file out. I'm not sure whether the kids had been filed out before the merchant venturers. And they all did this sort of slightly peculiar thing, as where they came out into the aisle in the middle. They would do their bow, their heads to the altar right at the front. Maybe that's a high church thing or something, I'm not sure. But that was certainly part of their ritual they seemed to do in the cathedral. I mean, the altar is something which is not biblical, by the way. In fact, I remember reading years ago about that St. Paul's Cathedral in London, right the way through the Blitz, and there's all these fantastic photographs of it with all the, you know, the fire and the clouds around St. Paul's. One bomb actually went through the dome of St. Paul's and it hit the cathedral, sorry, hit the altar and blew it to pieces. That was the only thing that happened in the Second World War. One of those little weird little things. But what about the actual the merchants today? Because there have been calls by you and others, Christine, to actually for them to disband. And for these people should be just gone and to play no part in the city in the future. Is that realistic, do you think?
Yes. I mean, I think we're getting closer to that. Karen Smith, the Labour MP for South Bristol, she gave an interview just before Christmas to Neil Maggs of the Cable. And she was kind of saying, you know, it's a medieval institution. What are they doing? You know, what is the purpose of these people? And the organiser, you know, the merchants would say, well, we run the trusts and, you know, we're involved in running old people's homes and, you know, we run the schools. And it's like, well, you can do that. You don't have to be a member of this society in order to do that.
Well, that reminds me of actually is the Freemasons, because whenever you talk about them, that's what they say. And there are some similarities, because if you look at the senior officers at the Merchant Venturers, you've got the master who is in charge. Well, of course, you get a similar thing in the Masons with the Grand Master of Masonry, and you get your Worshipful Master in the lodge, running the lodge. But more interestingly, it's the deacon. Have a deacon or hang on, that's in the Freemasonry. But you've got these two roles, which are the next year's master and 2 years' time's master, which exactly echo the Freemasons. So there is something a bit Masonic about this.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, it's all about tradition and ritual and kind of, you know, this is how we've done things. And so this is how we'll continue to do it, because it's about maintaining the positions of influence that they currently have.
It's the junior warden and the senior warden, which is going to be the next 2 years masters of the merchant venturers.
Can I just make the point, as somebody who works currently in a local authority school, why are the merchant venturers allowed to run schools? What educational qualifications do they have? And this is a big question.
Well, they have money. They have money.
So in other words, that is exactly what's wrong. They shouldn't be running schools at all, in my view.
And also the view of an ex-head teacher of Colston Girls' School, John Whitehead, who said after the statue came down that the people that run the Venturous Trust are not fit to be involved in education. I agree with John Whitehead.
They've got no qualifications, have they?
Well,
they are business people.
Yes, they are business people.
And that's all very well, but we don't want business people running schools. I mean, the charter schools in the US, schools, state schools, local authority schools, were taken over by McDonald's and the Marine Corps. That is not right.
But isn't it?
Schools shouldn't be to train up McDonald's staff.
Shouldn't be there to point
people in the direction of the Marine Corps.
I'm trying to get from Christine, to what extent that the money that is being spent on our pupils in these merchants' schools in the city, is that public money or is it merchants' money?
No, they're publicly funded state schools and they do have to publish how they spend that money. Yes, absolutely. But it's about laundering their reputation, isn't it? It's about so they can say, look, we run schools and, you know, we put our time into and our skills from business into running academy schools. It's about having that laundering of who they are and how they as individuals make their money.
Well, it's brilliant PR, and I can't help but think that all of these institutions which were sold off in the 1980s, mostly by the Thatcher government and then afterwards by the major government, the railways and things like that, what's happened is groups like the merchants have bought big shareholdings in these organisations. I think actually Bristol Water is an exception because it was always private. But you can see that these public utilities, this is where their money is invested. This is where their individuals sit on the board and where they have a tremendous amount of clout.
Well, if you remember when we were on FM, at BCFM, the only time we got a merchant venturer on the show...
Oh, yeah, Chris Curling, yeah.
Chris Covington, wasn't it?
Curling, I think.
Curling, all right.
Was, yeah.
Anyway, he came in that day, and it was only because you'd phoned him directly, you got his number,
didn't you?
Yeah. You phoned him directly and said, would you come on our show? And
yeah, don't go through their PR people.
Yeah, so you phoned him directly, and he said, yes, I will. And then, of course, all of his advisors saying, you don't want to go on that show, that's a really silly idea. But he said, oh, I'm going to do it. Anyway, so he came down, and that very morning, Bristol Water had been fined by Ofwat, the biggest fine ever for overcharging their customers. And it turned out that he was the lawyer on the board of Bristol Water, and therefore he was actually having to defend.
These are the sorts of people they are.
On the show.
They're corporate lawyers.
And people can check this on the archive.
Yeah.
They can find it on the archive.
Well, and what they were doing, let me just explain what they were doing at Bristol Water with Chris's advice. I mean, he's as a lawyer was saying, yeah, we can do this, no problem. Ofwat had a different opinion, which was to spend an absolute fortune, many, many tens of millions of pounds on revamping the Cheddar Reservoir, and they said they were going to do this and that, and there was a massive civil engineering works, and Ofwat said, well, this isn't necessary. So what they were doing was really creating a kind of a boondoggle for another firm that was going to do the civil engineering and build all this infrastructure that wasn't actually needed.
Yes, and the point was that what he said was, and he did admit it on the show, well, we're going to challenge this in court, and I'm a lawyer, and we won't pay this fine in the end, and guess what? They didn't.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay.
So is it, in a way, what's happened is the settlement after the Second World War, Martin, you know, with the Attlee government buying up so much of our infrastructure, things like railways, even parcel services, things like that, the infrastructure of the nation that Thatcher sold off in the 1980s. Really, the merchants are now sitting on much of those the wealth that's being made there. They're taking their cut rather than the taxpayer.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the other thing is that the school system used to be, like the healthcare system, off bounds for them. Mm. And of course what they've done with the academy structure is they've and what they're doing with the trust structure in the National Health Service is you make it look function as if it was the private sector, and then step by step it becomes the private sector. That's what's happening.
Well, Bristol likes to party, and I'm sure there was a terrific party this week after the acquittal of these four. The other question, though, is who's next? Looking at things, people like Cecil Rhodes. I mean, in Oxford, there's been a whole bit of controversy about that statue.
That's right, and it's still there at Oriel College, but the Oriel College had decided they were going to take it down, and that nobody said it should be destroyed. It'll be put in a museum or something. Mm. But then various funders of Oriel College, you know, the people who pay for new libraries and what have you, said that they would withdraw their funding if it went down. So the college decided they were going to remove it, and then they had second thoughts because all these people, made a fuss. And of course, there's been a very, very strong reaction on the right wing of British politics to what's happened in the court in Bristol, with various Tory MPs getting very hot under the collar about it all. And I understand Suella Braverman, the Attorney General is thinking of taking it to appeal court, but of course the appeal court can't overturn the jury's decision. But what they can, and of course in the Police and Criminal Justice Bill, there is a potential 10-year sentence for people who damage statues. Now, of course, what various lawyers have been saying, well, this will lead to jury trials where those who have damaged statues will say that they were justified for whatever reason. And in any case, jurors are not going to give a judge the right to send people to prison for 10 years for something like that. It won't work.
Suella Braverman is of Asian descent. As an ethnic person, do you think she might take that into account, making that decision?
Well, no, it does. I mean, what's happened in British politics is, you know, it's a good thing, really. The colour of your skin matters less than it did. It's actually the colour of your money that matters. Rishi Sunak is one of the wealthiest men in the world.
Pretty Patel.
Should he be the Chancellor of the Exchequer because he's super, super wealthy? Is that what we want a Chancellor of the Exchequer to be? And of course, that's the issue. And I think the world moves on. You know, the dogs bark and the caravan moves on. And I think it's been the whole. I think when they're saying that the court shouldn't be politicised, that's what courts are for. This was a non-violent act. Nobody was hurt. Mm. It's an act of civil disobedience. Well, therefore, it's not a. You know, if somebody had been hurt, then there'd be a different issue. But nobody was hurt here. You know, I mean, a few years ago, two women were put in front of a jury in Liverpool for damaging millions of pounds worth of damage on Tornado bombers, which were going to be used in East Timor.
Oh, hang on, this is the Hawks, actually, we're talking about. Yeah, this is that was a perfect.
And then the jury
case,
decided
actually,
that was absolutely justifiable direct action, and there were millions of pounds worth of damage. The other interesting thing about the Colston statue, of course, is that now in its current state in the M shed, it's worth far, far more than it was worth when it was sitting down in the centre of the town. If you sold it on eBay, you'd get a fortune for it.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's actually made it more valuable rather than less valuable.
More valuable than a Banksy, even.
Yeah.
And that's actually a key limb of criminal damage. A key legal limb of criminal damage is that the value has been reduced.
Yeah.
And that that expert valuation.
And you're supposed to pay that difference. Yeah, so maybe you get a check.
Well, the expert, the expert witness valuation was presented to the judge, and the judge ruled that it could not be admissible to the jury. So the jury didn't hear that piece of evidence.
Nevertheless, it's true. And if you think about it, it's obvious.
It's true. Yeah,
nobody heard of. Most people walked past that statue, apart from the militant minority, and ignored it. They didn't know what it was.
I mean, I think this whole sort of contested history is fascinating in this city. I mean, we had the whole business. I mean, we're sitting in the People's Republic of Stokes Croft studio now, and the PRSC were curating an art gallery at the Bear Pit, which is just 5 minutes walk from us down into town, which many people go through on their way to and from work every day, right next to the bus station. And they had a whole bunch of paintings up there in the anniversary of the First World War. There was one which was which had some words from a local councillor who was a conscientious objector.
He was actually an MP eventually.
Was he? He became an MP as well. So he was a conscientious objector in the First World War, and he wrote some things about, condemning it as a pointless war or that sort of thing. And one of the Conservatives walked through there and said, oh, this is terrible, we mustn't allow this in Remembrance Sunday. And the council security, despite the fact that, our arts centre actually was curating it, decided they were going to go and take that down. So there is, I think, a lot to be gained by actually pushing these buttons, actually, and by actually pointing out some of our history, and a tremendous amount to be gained by doing our diligent research on what really happened, and not just taking it from the bishop or anyone else as to what happened in this city's past.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, this idea you can't change history. I mean, there are whole it's an academic subject, isn't it? I mean, people study it, and you go back into the archives and you reframe things. Women have been written out of history because men largely have written it. Do you know what I mean? LGBT people with disabilities, they've been written out of history. But of course, they've always existed. It's not like people became gay in the 80s and that there were never any gay or lesbian people before then. It's just
for thousands of years, people thought we were all created. I'm not saying we are or we aren't, but nowadays most people are taught and believe that in the theory of evolution, something so massive in our history could be completely turned on its head. This is, I think, a point of contest, Martin, over the years, isn't it? We're going to still be deciding about our history probably in many years to come.
As Christine points out, history is an academic subject, and that means people are paid to go back over it again and again and rewrite it and rethink it. Yeah. I mean, I read lots of books about the English Civil War, for example, which is now called, in academic circles, the War of the Three Kingdoms, because it wasn't just in England at all. Most people died in Ireland.
Ireland, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, that was written out of the traditional history of the English Civil War.
Yeah.
I just wonder where... I mean, at the moment, the statue's not on display. I understand it.
That it was taken. Yeah,
it was for a while.
Yeah,
sort it was of in the end. Side.
Yeah, it was kind of
because it won't stand up anymore.
In
apparently,
state or something. Yeah, like it was lying in state. Yeah, so it was in the M shed for a number of months, but I think that it's recently gone back into storage, and we await to see what our great leader Marvin Rees decides that his history commission wants to do with it.
Well, it's strange that he doesn't see this as something that should be out on this public display. If nothing else, it would attract. I mean, he spends enough on the people who are supposed to attract tourists to Bristol, so why not have it there for tourists to come and have a look at? Maybe we'll have to remake it and have our own version out there so people can come and see it. But I find it very strange that we're now in the situation where that is not allowed to be seen. You can have a look at a picture of it on the internet, but you're not allowed to go and see the actual statue itself. In a way, the council have endorsed what people did by pulling it down.
I'm not sure that it will never come back out again. I mean, it went up, so there was going to be this consultation about what people wanted to do with it and what their ideas were. We wait to see what the outcome of that is, I think. And the M shed had that particular space for that kind of temporary display, if you like, to do that consultation. So we just have to wait and see what is going to happen to it,
well,
if anything.
Marvin Rees was on Points West yesterday live, saying that he hadn't been following the trial. He wasn't really interested.
I know, which is so different, isn't it, to when it actually went in the river, because he couldn't get his face off the television or his voice off the radio, and he's been dining out on that internationally ever since. And, this is a man who had TV cameras behind the scenes making a fly on the wall documentary that was following him immediately after the statue went into the river. So the idea that he wasn't following what was going on in the trial is absolute nonsense. And the reason that he's trying to kind of distance himself from it is because he knows that he's trying to sit on the fence and please everybody, and he has completely lost his own integrity because he didn't have any.
Well, the other thing is that for many years people have been talking about, and even Marvin in his original election campaign was talking about this idea of having some sort of permanent either memorial or sort of exhibition or something to do with the slave trade here in the city, because it is part of our past. I can remember being involved in the Cultural Development Partnership years ago when an exhibition was set up at the Empire Museum at Temple Meads, which was a really good and warts and all look at Bristol and Britain's slaving past. And I thought this was a very, very powerful and great thing to do. But having said that, the curator of the museum was booted out just after that by apparently pure coincidence, and there were people in the city that were not happy about that. And in fact, they only just about squeezed through their lottery funding to put that exhibition on. This is still a very thorny issue that people, there's some people in the city that don't want to go there, Christine.
Yeah, well, we need a permanent memorial so that, the ancestors of some of our communities and the work and the contribution they made to building Bristol and, other other areas around the world is kind of recognised and understood. And we need a permanent museum, a permanent space that explains this aspect of Bristol's involvement in this horrific period of history.
Yeah, that would really launch the ball, wouldn't it? But is the mayor interested in that?
I don't think so, no.
No, he doesn't seem to be. In fact, the building which the city council had earmarked for it was, I think, under George Ferguson, was then sold off to a private developer. So as much is going on. Anyway, what do you make of Marvin? Because he is of mixed race. He is of Jamaican descent. I noticed he was saying that, you know, his descendants could possibly have been sent across the Atlantic, enslaved by Edward, or made money for Edward Colson, not his by ancestors. Him by directly, yeah.
His ancestors, not his descendants.
His ancestors, yeah. Well, I hope so, yeah. But then, of course, that is true for something like 16,000 people in Bristol we've got of Jamaican descent.
Well, yeah, anybody of Afro-Caribbean descent is in that same position, because that's the history of kind of Bristol's relationship with Africa.
So how close is Marvin Rees, our Blairite Labour mayor, to the Merchant Venturers? Because one has to wonder, you know, what side is he on this debate? He seems to be trying to play both sides.
The example I would use, I think, with that is YTL is run by Colin Skellett. He was a merchant venturer, and YTL are building the arena, aren't they, up in Filton. And despite Marvin Rees saying, yes, we're going to have the arena in Temple Meads, when he first got into power in 2016.
Well, also, that would make a tremendous amount of sense, because it's already you've got a massive railway station where people can come to it. It's in the city centre. Many tens of thousands of people in the city could walk to an event there, but no, they won't be able to do that up in Filton, will they?
Not for Bristolians, no. So, you know, why the arena was moved, who knows what the decision-making was around that as to why the arena went up there, because that was an election promise he made in 2016.
And what about the referendum as to whether there is going to be a mayor? When's that going to take place, do you know?
My understanding is that will be in May of this year, so a couple of months' time, and it will be for, you know, the voters in Bristol to go out and vote. Hopefully we'll get a high turnout, but the Green Party,
there was a very low turnout for the first one, wasn't there?
I think incredibly low. I'm hoping it will be higher than that this time round.
So anyway, what's your pitch on this? What is the difference between having a mayor and the committee system, the old system?
It's about concentration of political power, because the committee system spreads that power. So the committee system will be a mix, a cross-party mix for the decision-making process, whereas the mayor can pretty much overrule anything that happens in full council. There's only very limited areas. The budget is one of them, and, you know, voting to have that referendum is another one. Planning and licensing, about the only things that the mayor doesn't have all the executive power over, but literally everything else he does. And what's since happened is that we now have a WECA mayor, don't we? The West of England combined authority.
The Metro mayor. So we've got one mayor within another mayor.
Yes. So it's kind of, you know, the Bristol mayor's almost become obsolete from that perspective. So there's that, is an added idge, if you like. But the other thing that happened before we had an elected mayor was that Bristol was having ward elections. A third of the ward councillors were up 3 out of 4 years. So all the political parties were in this kind of election mode, three out of every 4 years. Now that's changed. So everybody is up for election, and then you have a settled period of 4 years where it's the same people that are on the council. And that's only happened since 2016.
Martin, what's your view on this?
Well, I think it's the having all-out elections is clearly better.
Mm.
I mean, I remember the previous system, and it was just exhausting for political activists.
Because
every year we were out knocking on doors. And, of course, it led to a situation where you can never be sure who's actually in charge.
Yes.
And, the Lib Dems and the Labour Party at one stage were very closely matched. So, you know, just one council ward could change, and then the whole thing had to change.
Yeah.
And it just led to, you know, stasis and paralysis. I'm not generally in favour of having elected mayors. I think one of the problems you're going to find, though, in May is, because there is no election, it may be that the turnout about whether to have a mayor or not is not nearly enough to have give you a decisive result that you can say that's what people really wanted one way or the other. I think probably lots of people will who want to get rid of the mayor will vote. But the people who basically don't care either way won't vote. But the question is, what sort of mandate will you get out of that? But of course, the mayoral system was brought in. I think it was 14% of the people voted for having a mayor. And that was because it had been written on the back of an envelope by David Cameron. Well, it was basically, let's have some mayors.
Yeah, this was something called the City Deal done with Clegg, wasn't it? And it's basically a US system. Let's have an American type system here.
The British politics. I mean, obviously, I'm in favour of PR and so on, but British politics has been based on having committees with a primus inter pares, a prime minister, as it were. At the top of it, yeah. Whereas directly elected individuals personalises everything to an enormous extent.
This is going on with Boris at the moment, isn't it? He's got the right wing in his own party and making him feel very shaky. He might be replaced.
Well, that's possible. I mean, it's going to be a very interesting year politically.
Yeah, so he has to actually, Britain. He can't just do what he wants. He's got a big, there are checks and balances within the Tory party.
Well, I mean, this is also true. I mean, Biden is directly elected, but ultimately the US system is again a mess because he's directly elected, but the Congress can block him. And the Senate, where you've got two people elected for every state, means that small states like Vermont and Delaware get two senators, and California with millions and millions of people gets two senators.
So,
system is, you know, democracy is a work in progress in Britain, in the US, everywhere. Well, we're not there yet.
We've been talking a lot about the past. What about, and also of course about the future governance of the city. What about the future look of the city? Because there was some horrific stuff over the holiday in the Bristol Post. It was just actually the day before we packed up, but I missed it. Historic England hits out a decision to build monolithic office buildings in Bristol city centre. You said, Christine, that the mayor doesn't control planning, but he seems to have a certain amount of influence over it. We feel the harm resulting from these proposals is unnecessary. Historic England is... hitting out at Bristol City Council's decision to approve plans to build three new office blocks on the edge of Castle Park. Planning committee members voted in favour of the MECP's proposals. This is some private business for St Mary LaPorte site the week before Christmas, which currently contains a cluster of three eyesore buildings surrounding a ruined church tower. Well, they don't really surround it, actually. No, they're nearby it, but they don't surround it. The three former bank buildings at the corner of Wine Street and High Street will be replaced with one 9-storey and two 8-storey office blocks with independent retailers, cafes, restaurants and bars at ground level. And it's been interesting to I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, something called the Bristol Campaign Against Tower Blocks. There's some really damning comments there saying in no other city in Europe would this be allowed. What the European cities do in city centres is they look at the character of the surrounding buildings. Perhaps, I mean, because this area was bombed in the Second World War, they allow planning permission to rebuild buildings which maybe are putting back something that was there that was bombed by the Nazis in the Blitz. But they certainly don't just allow them to put up three, you know, square, ugly looking office blocks in such an important part of the city.
I agree. I mean, I don't sit on planning, and it's not an area that I know, you know, I'm still learning around the planning legislation. But I agree. I think it's a monstrosity. I question why offices are needed, given the pandemic that we've been through and the changes that clearly we're able to make in the way that certain people in certain area industries are able to work. But you've only got to walk through Queen Square and see all the offices to let signs and just ask yourself why it is that we need offices in the first place. What this city needs is affordable and social rent housing. That's what we need in the city. You know, we've got 16,000 people on the housing waiting list. That's what the city needs, not offices.
And we've had George Ferguson on this programme, the previous mayor, who's also a former chairman of a president, I think, actually, of the Royal Institute of British Architects, talking about this sort of thing where bits of land, which are natural places for people to congregate in the centre, for example, Castle Park, which you get thousands of people sitting out in the sun in the summertime there, and it's a place where people go in their lunch breaks, maybe if you want to take an hour, have a cup of coffee whilst you've been shopping, whatever you're doing in the city, that's the place to go. But no, we're not going to have anything public there, which the public can enjoy, we're going to have more offices. Amazing. And George Ferguson has written, actually, in the Architects Journal just a couple of days ago, the 6th of January, yesterday, he's saying the gloves are off. Greedy development is disfiguring Bristol. Nearby Bath was saved from crude planning and crude architecture in the 1970s, but we're facing a similar sacking of Bristol, writes former city mayor and REBA president George Ferguson. Bristol's history, special character and environment are under attack from more damaging development than we've seen in the last 50 years. Martin, what he's saying is basically what's going on now is that the city's landscape into the future has been thrown to the Philistines.
Well, I mean, it's the if you know anything about planning law, you'll know that developers do have a great deal of power. And even if the city council decided that it didn't want this development, the developers can appeal to central government and they'll generally get what they want. So local councils can be overridden. So a lot of, even if we had a committee system council, you would still find that there was tensions around this issue. We need strong local planning laws, which of course we used to have in the 1940s and 50s, but they've all been gradually undermined.
But even the planning inspectors that would look at that appeal don't approve of massive concrete framed tombstones blighting Castle Park in the city centre.
Well, I mean, what's being built there at the moment, which
that's
is
what George's
I tend to agree, but of course there is already one being completed as we speak, which is a great big enormous building, and that basically is luxury flats. And you've got exactly the same thing happened all along the Thames in London. Luxury flats have been built in which, in actual fact, hardly anybody is registered to vote because nobody lives in them. They're actually where Colombian drug lords and Kazakhstan oligarchs put their money. And so they stay there and they're empty. And they're basically a store of wealth for the oligarchy, the global oligarchy.
Well, let me just read a little bit more of George's. I'll put a link up to the article in the Architects Journal on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He says this is just the beginning. The city council has recently been holding secret competitions for sensitive sites advised by agents. One such competition is for an office block on the site previously designated for the Centre for Performing Arts. It can be summed up as a well-designed, oversized rectangular business park building with the most uncomfortable relationship to its harbourside setting, especially to Millennium Square, onto which it backs. Now, Christine, this is not the way things should be. This is our city's future. We're going to be looking at these for decades, maybe even hundreds of years to come. And yet there is no, it seems to me, consideration given for this being the centre of a historic city. This is just, okay, let's just put up something which is as high as possible and as cheap to build as possible and as high rent as possible. That's what the city centre is about to these people. It's about high rents. It's not about a living space.
I agree with you. And I think that this kind of, you know, what's going on in the Cumberland Basin or the Western Harbour, as apparently it's now called, could well go down the same route. And that is on the edge of my ward, and it's Green Council's all around that, and we're going to really fight with that. I mean, I agree with George Ferguson on this. I think that the city, you know, we really need to be very, very careful about the types of buildings that we allow to go up, particularly in the city centre, because of the historic nature of the city centre. But also we want people to be able to live in the city centre, and we need affordable social rent housing. We need to be able to, we need families to be brought back into the city centre. And we need to be able to live in that city centre. I don't always agree with George Ferguson. There are things, particularly around education, that I completely disagree with him about. But on the architectural side, I do take my hat off to him. He does know what he's talking about. He is interested in the historic nature, particularly of the city centre. And I agree with him completely on this.
Well, okay. So he's supposed to be a Labour mayor. That's what people voted for. But George is pointing out, Martin, he has an unquestioning alliance between business and the mayor.
Well, I think this is part of the problem with local authorities used to have far more powers than they currently have. So the mayoral system is like local authority. I mean, if you think back to the 1950s in Bristol, the local authority ran the schools, it ran the buses. It provided council houses. So who had got elected?
It even used to run at-cost restaurants in the city centre for people who were hungry.
In other words, the local authorities, and of course they were funded through the rates, which is a much fairer system than council tax.
So let's just make it clear. The rates were levied on property owners.
Yes, and of course you've still got rates funding local government in Northern Ireland, because they didn't dare to bring in the poll tax in Northern Ireland, because of course in the poll tax and community charge, if you don't pay, bailiffs can come around and take your stuff. Now in Northern Ireland,
hang on, I'm thinking slavery again. On earth are these taxes being levied on the poor?
Well, it was originally because Margaret Thatcher realised that what was happening in Lambeth, where I used to live at the time, was that people in Streatham in big houses were being given rate bills which were quite steep because they're quite expensive houses, and that was being used to provide youth clubs in Brixton. And her attitude was, if people want youth clubs in Brixton, they've got to pay for them. Why should we pay for them? So that was the whole idea of the poll tax, where everybody was going to pay the same, if you remember.
Yeah.
The poorest resident was going to pay exactly the same as the richest resident. And, of course, it was introduced in Scotland and caused, mainly really put a bomb under the independence movement up there. But, of course, they never dared to introduce it in Northern Ireland, because can you imagine bailiffs walking down either the Falls or the Shankill Road to go and take people's tellies away? What would happen to them? They'd end up dead in a ditch.
They probably would, yeah. Well, this idea of regressive taxes, let's look at the increases in fuel prices now, because this came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, where we did have, maybe I should play first Keir Starmer's little talk, because he did it before Prime Minister's Questions, and then he tested positive for COVID, so he had to go and isolate. I don't know why he can't do a kind of Zoom Prime Minister's Questions, but anyway, for some reason he can't, and he let Angela Rayner take over from him. But this is clearly a massive issue right now in the country, is people are looking at incredibly inflated energy bills into this year. The parallels are, of course, should be anyway, be made with places like Kazakhstan, where people have come out onto the streets over this. Anyway, this is Wednesday, Angela Rayner standing in for Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions.
Angela Rayner!
Mr Speaker, I've heard on the grapevine there might be a vacancy for Prime Minister soon, so maybe I should have aspirations. The Prime Minister pretends it's not his fault. He blames the global forces. He blames the market. Mr Speaker, we're an aspirational party. Maybe the Prime Minister needs to be more aspirational for this country. But, Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister has made political choices that has led us into this place. His government has failed to invest in long-term energy security. His government decided to let gas storages collapse. His government let the energy market run out of control. 27 energy companies have gone bust in the last year. And now household bills are going through the roof. Or as the money-saving expert Martin Lewis put it, there will be a seismic hit on energy bills. Yep. Can't the Prime Minister see what's happening yet again? Working families are picking up the tab for his incompetence.
Yeah. Well, Mr Speaker, she talks about energy. I think the House will agree she's got a lot more energy than the current leader of the opposition, and I welcome her point, because actually what the government is doing is supporting people throughout the...